You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this month to talk about Marvel Treasury Edition number 25, Spider-Man versus the Hulk at the Winter Olympics, timely, is my pal and fellow podcaster, Tom Panarese. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
I am doing great. I am so excited to talk about this incredibly goofy Treasury Edition that we have laid here in front of us. But unbelievably, Tom, you have not been on the show before.
No, I haven't.
We've recorded a bunch of shows together. We've never been on Treasury Cast. So I get to ask this question. Like, do you have any particular history with the Treasury format at all?
Very little. I think it started to fade out a little before, like right around the time where I would have maybe discovered comic books, because this came out in late 79.
Yep.
And I was born in June of 77. So I would have been about 2.5 when this came out. The only Treasury edition I remember, and my friend had it, I never had it when I was little, when I was a kid, was the Star Wars one. Mm. You know, the Howard Chicken drawn, you know,
Marvel printed about a billion of those.
Yeah. And in fact, I was at a comic show a couple of years back, and I saw like somebody had like easily a dozen of them on a stand, and he wanted like $30 for each of them. And I'm like, yeah, that was a little too steep for me, considering I have it in an omnibus. Like, mm-hmm. I could read it. So by the time I got to really even just acknowledging like what comics were and stuff like that, most of the comics were just regular size format. I think Marvel was putting out like the magazine size super specials, mm-hmm. for a while too. Although I was usually getting, so like I never had the Return of the Jedi one. I had the mini series that they published in regular format. But I did at one point, and I think I sold it for a couple bucks on eBay. I ended up with a Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer one. That, you know, DC put out like 4 of those or something.
A lot, so. Put about 8 of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
who got you that?
I think it had to be
a relative, right? Like an aunt or something.
No, I had it. You know what? I had it actually. It was within the last decade, and I think I found it really, really cheap.
Okay.
In a bin somewhere at a sale. And it was just one of those. It was one of those things. Well, I got to get this. This is ridiculous. And I think I sold it for $3 because it was damaged. And some kid had colored in it, you know. I think I covered it. I used it for an episode of my podcast. It's probably why I was looking for it. But yeah, no, I never really had a ton of them. It was more of the magazine size stuff and the super specials here and there over the years through the 80s, because I really don't remember owning many comics before like 84, 85, mm-hmm. or so. But I've seen some of these things in reprints and in like digital stuff like that. And I do own the Shag was on my show about a year ago at this point to talk about the X-Men Teen Titans crossover, and I have the crossover classics trade that came out that reprinted the Spider-Man, Superman treasuries and mm-hmm. the Batman Incredible Hulk mm-hmm. one, in addition to the X-Men Titans one. So I've read a few here and there.
Yeah, the treasury format was pretty much all done from DC Marvel, just as kind of you were buying comics. Mm-hmm. So the overlap really didn't happen at all. So you had said, other than that Rudolph, you don't own any treasuries, you know, actual treasuries sitting on your shelf somewhere?
No, and I see them. I see them in my comic store from time to time, but they're you know, they go for like $20, especially if they're in really good condition. And depending on what it is, like I've seen a couple of Batman ones that that have gone for like $25-$30. I'm just like, I can't justify the expense for that. You know, I found that I did not know until a few years ago when my LCS had it on the wall that there was a G.I. Joe number one treasury edition.
Yes. Yeah.
And again, so no, I've never actually gone out and bought and collected them. I'm trying to limit how much stuff I bring into the house.
That's eminently reasonable. Yeah. Actually, I got to say, 25, if you're seeing a local comic shop with a treasury for 25, 30, that's pretty low at this point. That's actually pretty, I mean, unless the thing is really damaged and say some kid colored in all the Batman puzzles. That's actually a pretty good price. You see them in cons now. It's like even the kind of lower end treasuries are going for like 50. It's the market has just shot right up. It's kind of ridiculous, really.
Yeah. On the other hand, your other show, The Digests, you can still get those for a pretty decent price. I have a couple of those at home.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would love, I've said this, I think, on other shows, if I had unlimited time, I would do another show about the Marvel magazine format because I love those. I love treasuries. I love digests, but I also did love the magazines. And they, unlike the treasuries, Marvel held on to them for a while. I mean, they kept the magazines well into the 80s.
Yeah, I have... So I have a couple of issues of the 80 Savage Tales run.
Yep.
Because that had the Michael Golden, Doug Murray, fifth to the first
stuff. Yeah, and then, right.
And I have one or two of they did a NOM magazine where they were reprinting some of the early stuff. And I can't remember how many issues they had.
That makes total sense. Knowing that the Marvel magazine audience was kind of older and male, like very specific older and male, that makes complete sense that they would format it like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. And that was that those you can still get for depending on what it is, from like $5 to $20, depending on the, you know, some of the older, like the Conan ones can go for a decent amount of money, especially if they're the older Conan ones, but the Punisher magazine, the NOM things, it's, you know, you can still find them for under $10 here and there, and that's pretty cool to see. It's been a while since I've seen one actually that I wanted to buy, but I'm always flipping through the Mads, flipping through the DC ones where they still have the oversized graphic novels from the 80s. But I'm like, no, I can't justify paying, you know, $20 for Nighthawks or whatever the heck that it was. some of those sci-fi ones where I'm like, curious.
Yeah.
Me and Joe Priest.
there were some odd things. Now that we're talking about it, I really feel like I should start my magazine show before the prices go up over on those. get them cheap. But it's like, if I wait a couple more years, I'll be like, oh, great. The Nightmare on Elm Street magazine is now $30 an issue. It's ridiculous. So I gotta get on that, everybody. So, okay. Also related to what we're going to be talking about, where are you on the Olympics? I asked this of Sean Myers when he came on last summer when we did the Laugh Olympics Summer Olympics special. So as we're recording this, we are hip deep in the Winter Olympics over in Beijing. So, I mean, because I know you're a fan of the Olympics, that's why you're here.
Yeah.
But where are you on, say, the winter? Like, do you watch all of it? Do you watch some of it? Where are you?
I watch as much as I can. I really, really enjoy it. So, I mean, I am unfortunately shackled to Comcast because it's it's really the only good provider in this area.
Yep. That's a good word for it, shackled.
Yeah. But the advantage of that is that, you know, I have access to kind of their in-guide menu will give you everything for the Olympics. So usually we tend to stick to NBC's primetime stuff because, you know, they'll show stuff and a lot of it's just kind of like nice. It's always like mindless sports sometimes. Like, you know, yeah, you watch ski runs over and over and over again. It's almost like watching baseball. I love watching baseball, but one of the reasons I like watching baseball is you can ignore baseball for several innings. And, I'll catch some hockey and I do love watching curling. it's like, I don't know why. It's so fascinating. And then, we don't really have a particular sport that we like really gravitate toward. Although maybe it's because I came of age in the late 80s and early 90s when the women's figure skating was like really coming into this, the height of its prominence. It had a kind of a golden age in the early 90s, not, you know, the Nancy Kerrigan, Tanya Harding thing withstanding. But I mean, so like, we're all about the figure skating. It's that it's, I joke with some of my friends that like guys will make themselves out to be like an authority on everything, especially sports. Like they'll never watch figure skating and yet they catch like the women's figure skating free skate. And all of a sudden it's like, and that triple Lutz, it's really, really difficult. Like they know like all the ins and outs of it. It's like, shut up and watch the thing. So yeah, but no, I'm a huge dork for the Olympics. And not only that, like I started watching them. The first Olympics I remember was the 84 Summer Games. I might have seen the 84 Winter Olympics, but I was about 7 years old and I remember watching the 84 Olympics. And then the Winter Games that I first remember watching like rabidly was the 88 Calgary Games, because I was watching like all the hockey. Mm-hmm. All the hockey. And because I'm a big hockey fan. And then so basically since then, I tend to watch both the winter and the summer. I do prefer the winter more. I think the sports are just, I don't know why. I mean, I love watching the Summer Olympics, but the Winter Olympics, I find, I don't know, maybe it's the, as my coworker says, it's because of the, there's a higher chance of somebody actually dying in a competition.
Wow.
So it's like, wow. I was watching the ski the other day. I was looking at the mountain that they're on in Beijing and I'm like, yeah, is that net really going to catch you?
I think about that sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. But the other thing I'm into, and HBO Max has graced us with these, and I think they're still on there, is that the Olympics documentaries, especially the Bud Greenspan ones, like 16 Days of Glory from 1984. And I used to rent that when I was a kid. We rented it a couple of times through the video store. The video store had like, my video store was awesome, man. Sable's Video Empire. And they had a sports section. And if my friends and I weren't renting crappy action movies, we were hitting the sports section and we were renting, I would rent the Olympic videos and 16 Days of Glory by Bud Greenspan. At that point, it was just a 2-hour tape. But we would also rent like all the WWF WrestleMania, like, you know, because they had all the WrestleManias. We would just keep renting WrestleManias. But about a year or so ago, HBO put a bunch of them on HBO Max, and there's like a 5-hour version of this movie. And I sat, and what's cool is that it's done in segments. So like I would sit and watch one segment, and like, it took me several days to complete this documentary, but like it's so well done. And I've watched, I think the only one I have left to watch is the one on Nagano. But I do really, really enjoy watching. I like sports documentaries anyway, almost as much as I like rock documentaries. So, you know, so you get me something about the Olympics, baseball, punk rock scene of the 1980s. I'm in.
This Venn diagram of those three things. And then right in the center is Tom Paneris. It says it right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. 16 Days of Glory, the Decline of Western Civilization. Yeah.
Right. Who rented the Olympics and the G.G. Allen documentaries? Oh, that's Tom Paneris. Stuff, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, exactly. So. But no, I love this stuff. It's, although NBC's coverage is so like, I think I tweeted out right around the time of the opening ceremonies that nothing makes rooting for the USA feel more smarmy than NBC's Olympics coverage. It's so, so irritating.
Yeah. I, like you, we are, as again, a perfect word for it, shackled to Comcast. So I'm having to watch either the live stuff or I watch Peacock, which comes free. And thank God Peacock comes free, because I would never pay for it. Peacock is like the worst app in the history of apps.
Yeah, it's just buggy. It's
constantly buggy, and it like, you know, they have things grouped in weird ways. And so it really makes it like hard to watch. I know this is so totally first world problems, but nevertheless, I love the Olympics. I love both. I love the winter and the summer. And, you know, just wanting to watch some of this stuff is painful. Now, I love snowboarding. I can watch team snowboarding all day and all night. Those guys just, and men and women, just sailing down that mountain in the air on those boards is just amazing to me. And I like speed skating. And so and like, again, figure skating, like, you know, I would never watch figure skating outside of the Olympics ever. I don't care. It's not, but when it's Olympics, then it's interesting. So yeah, I have been enjoying it, but man, yeah, some of the, it's like, the replays are weird and the group thing. And you're just like, man, you guys are really making this hard to enjoy, because you're just putting it together in such a weird way.
Yeah. Well, I pointed out the other night, as we're recording this, the other night was that snowcross, the mixed relay snowcross race with Lindsay Jacob Ellis and Baumgartner, I think his last name was. And since they were airing that live, and that thing runs at a really nice clip, like the first run makes their way down the mountain. The second run is already ready to go. They don't have to reset the track. And they had no time to do the crap they usually do. So we were sitting there watching it, like, not ignoring it. Like, usually you ignore parts of it, you kind of tune it out. And like, we were on the edge of our seats that entire time. And it was like some of the best coverage I've seen NBC do in years, because they didn't have the time to really pad it out. They had to actually do their job.
There was one, I watched it a couple of days ago, and there was some skier, I forget who it was, but like she had screwed up. And like fell.
Oh, Michaela Schifrin.
Was that? Oh yeah. Oh my God. And they got her right as she was done. And like the guy interviewing her is like, how do you feel? And the poor girl looked like she wanted to just die. And he keeps like asking her questions. And I wanted to just say, just walk away. Don't like, I know I've disappointed. I don't know. And I'm like, let the poor woman go into the lodge and have a hot cocoa. Leave her alone, for God's sake. Cut the commercial for Pete's sake. You're killing me over
here. The look is like, I'm trying not to vomit right now.
Yeah.
Because I'm so upset.
And so bad. Oh my God.
I know.
It's just like, come on. What are you doing? So I think we could both agree, Tom, that one way to improve the Olympics would be if Spider-Man and the Hulk showed up.
Oh, yeah. And Mole Man.
And Mole Man. So obviously Marvel felt the same, because they produced Marvel Treasure Edition number 25, Spider-Man versus Hulk at the Winter Olympics. Obviously, it was on sale December 1st, 1979. Obviously, the perfect tie-in to the Winter Olympics. This story is by Bill Mantlow, Mark Gruenwald, Stephen Grant, Herb Trimpe, and Bruce Patterson. Now, before we get to my endless plot synopsis, because, man, this thing is – Bill Mantlow always gave readers value for their money. He did not skimp on plot. Let's talk about the front cover of this image by Al Milgrom and Jack Abel. And it's basically just what you would expect. It's the Hulk and Spider-Man fighting in what is clearly the Winter Olympics. We see, like, the little ski lift, and there's people running around. There's some skis. And it says all new, all exciting. So what do you think of this as a cover?
It's – Hulk has the entire, that's a, you know, there's something to be said about perspective, because Hulk is holding the ski lift pole, you know, the thing that actually holds the wires that hold the ski lift chairs. And he's going to swing it around like Hulk. Those things are like three stories high.
The size of a building. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I don't know what Spider-Man is doing. He's dodging skis being thrown at him. Spider sense is tingling. Luckily, everybody in the background is acting as everybody in the background should, like, oh crap, we need to get out of here right now.
Yeah, just run away. Just absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's not like, you know, a particularly great cover, but it's delivering what you expect from the title, Spider-Man versus the Hulk at the Winter Olympics. This is exactly what it is. You know,
one of the things about these that I've seen, and I have to remember, like, you know, this was 79, so the cartoon wasn't on, but, like, you know, I watched Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends when I was, you know, in my PJs as a kid Saturday mornings, and, like, this would have been right up my alley at the age of, like, 5, 6, 7 years old, you know, I mean, because it's just, oh, look, the Hulk and Spider-Man, and, like, you know, yeah, so this would have caught my attention when I was a little kid, plus if it was in that huge format. You know, sadly, they were kind of gone by then, but
yeah,
I probably would have wanted this when I was little.
Yeah, absolutely. And I said, we talk about one of the reasons I love the treasury format is that DC and Marvel realized when they had kind of like a big story, they wanted to give it this kind of deluxe presentation. And obviously, they're hoping to tie it in to, you know, maybe pick up some kids that are maybe sports kids, not necessarily comics kids. And by seeing Winter Olympics, it's like, oh, wow, maybe we can tie this in. And obviously, the Olympics, and maybe a lot of people don't even realize it, don't even think about it, like, the Olympics is like a copyrighted thing. You can't just, like, put the Olympic rings on things. You have to, like, that's like a licensed thing you would have to buy. Yeah. So like there is none of that. It's just like it doesn't say like the, it just says Winter Olympics in a kind of boring purple type because they couldn't show like the Olympic rings because that's again, you would have to pay for that.
Yeah.
So this is this kind of almost like a not bootleg, but it was kind of like off to the side. Like, well, yeah, it's at the, you know, at the, it's like Spider-Man and Hulk at the World Series. Well, yeah, but it's
kind of like how if you've ever noticed the way companies will advertise for this for stuff related to the Super Bowl, if they don't want to pay the NFL the rights to the name Super Bowl, they just use the phrase the big game.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, because that's not copyrighted, because Super Bowl is. Yeah, right, this is right. Kind of like what they did in the Winter Olympics. They probably could skirt the copyright and say claim fair use because, you know.
The Olympics are hundreds of years old, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I could see that in the 1980 Olympics were famously in Lake Placid.
Yep.
And when this came out, I don't think Carter had boycotted the Moscow Games yet. So not.
We'll talk about that at the end.
Yeah. So this was, so the Olympics taking place in the United States for the first time since, I want to say like the Squaw Valley Olympics in the 60s.
Wow.
So it's been a long time, you know, whereas, we've had, or we'll have them again in LA in 2028, but like, I think our last one actually was 20 years ago. It was Salt Lake City. It doesn't feel like that long ago.
No, but, it really doesn't. Yeah.
Well, especially since we had Vancouver too. So
yeah, you know, now that we're talking about it, now I kind of wish they had done Spider-Man and Captain America at the Super Bowl Treasury or something. That would have been really cool. You know, it would have been like Dr. Doom is going to set off a bomb
They basically adapt Black Sunday.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. To make it Black Sunday, just put superheroes in it. It would have been perfect. So, all right. So, as I mentioned, Bill Mantlo and Mark Gruenwald and Stephen Grant, three writers on this baby, they deliver a lot of plot, and I did my best to condense it down as much as I could, but this synopsis still is quite long. So everybody grab a beverage, get comfortable, and just bear with me as we get through this plot synopsis, and hopefully Tom will still be with us at the end. So, okay. At the location of the Winter Olympics, Lake Placid, New York, a gang of hooded figures are attempting to kidnap one of the Olympic figure skaters, but they are interrupted by the Amazing Spider-Man. The gang seems to have superpowers, as one of them throws his hands into the snow, causing a snowslide that almost buries the web-slinger. After managing to fight off three of them, the fourth, called Water Witch, uses a weapon to trap Spidey into an ice chamber. The kidnappers continue their pursuit of the ice skater, who tears one of their hoods off, revealing a monstrous visage. Spidey uses his strength to burst free of the ice prison, and then he sees the woman trapped in some sort of glowing gem, and as she sinks into the water, finds even he can't get purchase on it. The local police arrive and turn on some floodlights, causing the kidnappers to run away. The cops see Spider-Man and make their usual assumptions, causing Spidey to swing away. Spider-Man turns back into Peter Parker and joins the scrum of reporters who have arrived at the scene. This makes the third Olympian who has been kidnapped. Another Olympian named Brad is asked if he's considering dropping out because of what's been happening. He says, no way. He's waited his whole life for this. Peter Parker silently promises to help Brad keep his promise. The next morning, we see that the Incredible Hulk has been trapped in another one of these glowing gems. The Hulk is about to be grabbed by some rockmen, causing him to get even angrier and burst the gem. The Hulk fights off the rockmen and heads into a nearby cave looking for more of them, but he finds it empty. Well, not completely empty, as he is approached by a strangely dressed woman who says her name is Kala, destined to be queen of Subterranea. And if the Hulk helps her assume the role, he will be her king. Back at the games, Brad is about to compete in the ski jump. As he sails through the air, he is trapped in one of those gems and falls into the ground, sinking into the snow. Peter Parker suits up, but the goons we saw earlier get the drop on him and knock him out. He wakes up in a cave in front of the Mole Man. He reveals that he is having a war with Kala, who wants access to a fountain of youth that the Mole Man controls. Years ago, she spurned the Mole Man's love, and he's kind of bitter about it. The Mole Man wants to enlist Spider-Man in the fight, but of course Spidey wants no part of it. He tries to escape, but is blasted via the Mole Man's staff. We cut to a massive underground battle between the Mole Man and Kala's armies. Kala wants Hulk to help out, but all he wants to do is eat. Kala turns to her kidnapped Olympians to take the Hulk's place, good plan, suiting them up with advanced weaponry that their particular skills will help them wield. The Mole Man communicates with Kala and says this endless war is decimating both sides and proposes an Olympic Games of their own. Kala agrees, thinking that the Mole Man will not be prepared for her bringing the Hulk to the Games. Later, everyone in Lake Placid feels like what seems to be an earthquake. Suddenly, virtually the entire town is thrust into the air atop mile-high mechanical pylons. With a now captive audience, Mole Man and Kala let the games begin. The Hulk, drugged by Kala, only vaguely recognizes the Bug Man, and soon they are fighting, with Spidey just trying to stay alive. Meanwhile, Kala's Olympians compete against Mole Man's team of mutants. Kala aims her aging ray at Brad's girlfriend, Heather, driving Brad to head right for Kala on his souped-up power skis. Kala returns to her original age, making her old and withered. Her lava men are shocked, but the Mole Man declares himself the winner. But Mole Man is a graceful winner, telling Kala he still wants her as his queen, even in her true form. Meanwhile, the drugs the Hulk took wear off. Using his boot strength, he pounds the ground so hard that the metal pylons sink back into the ground. He then hops away, leaving Spider-Man and the Olympians. Brad remarks that by losing the race, he helped save Heather, leading Spider-Man to comment that Brad is the true champion, metal or not. Whew. Okay, I've been talking for a long time and I'm tired. So, Tom, talk about this book.
I did not have the Mole Man as an incel being the motivation for his plot.
But it tracks, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is a Saturday morning cartoon, man. It's fun. It's goofy as hell, but it is really, really fun. And I got a kick out of reading this because it's, you know, there's none of the Marvel pathos in here. You know, there's no Parker Luck kind of like soap opera drama. There's no, I don't even think Banner makes an appearance. I think it's just the Hulk shows up and is the Hulk the whole time. And so it's very play with the action figures, get him into crazy situations. The contest of champions, as it's called, chapter as it's called, of the Olympians fighting the Mole Men's people is so goofy. Hulk is in that gladiator costume when he's starting to fight.
It's like it does in Ragnarok.
Yeah, exactly. It does kind of look like what's in Ragnarok. And then Kala is in this. It's very Kirby New Gods type of getup. I mean, this isn't going to win any Eisners, but it's fun as heck, man. It is fun as heck.
Not going to win any Eisners. That's an understatement. Yeah. I mean, this thing is like Marvel at its like 70s zenith, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just action. You know, like you said, there's very little in the way of the pathos. It's just like, okay, let's just have crazy fun. I mean, right on page after this initial kind of front piece image of Spider-Man and the Hulk, and then we see the various Olympians competing, and then we get to this like this team of hooded guys with these giant claws. And I said, it's drawn by Herb Trimpe and Bruce Patterson. And I mean, again, the initial sequence, it's all just these guys with these crazy powers. The one guy has the giant like claw hands, Water Witch encases Spider-Man, as I said, in like the ice chamber. And then they're like, you know, the cops get a call. They're like, hey, there's something here you might want to be checking out. And then they go down and it's like, you know, they're immediately like, hey, Spider-Man, you're the problem. It's like, what? Wasn't everybody just watching? There was like five people trying to steal. Like, what the? It's just like, it's such the Marvel universe, this story.
Yeah. Yeah. And Herb Trimpe is a good artist for this. You know, he would go on to, he, like I mentioned G.I. Joe earlier, he drew G.I. Joe for on and off for years. And so I was very used to his art, at least at first. And when Patterson's a good inker on him because he, you know, I think the first time I encountered Herb Trimpe was in G.I. Joe versus the Transformers. But wow. Unfortunately, his inker there was Vince Coletta. Okay. Yeah, okay. So it kind of. Yeah. But I don't know. It's very like this doesn't need to be flashy, in these sort of you know. It doesn't need to be artistic in that way. He's a really solid artist for this, where you're got this goofy story where kids are going to be reading and they're going to have fun with it. So Spider-Man looks like Spider-Man. The Hulk looks like the Hulk. And the villains are colorful and crazy enough to make it dynamic and interesting. So
I'm betting I know the answer to this, but I wonder if like somebody like Herb Trimpe got like a higher page rate for a story like this, simply because Mantlo and Grant and Gruenwald, I'm betting most of this is Mantlo. This feels like a Mantlo story. mm-hmm. all the best ways, that like there's just so much going on in any given panel. You've got Olympians running around. You've got all these settings. You've got these. You got these four mutant guys. You got all this background stuff. Like this is a lot. This is a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, to having like you look at any one of these pages. Like, okay, let me give a perfect example. Like page 11. Again, we'll have some of the pages on our website, FrankWaterPodcast.com. Page 11. Right. The mutants have run away. The cops are there. And Spider-Man has turned back into Peter Parker, right? And they're interviewing this Brad guy. That is just a pretty standard page of a bunch of people talking. There are, let's see, 11 panels on this page, right? Some panels have something around half a dozen figures. You've got somebody lugeing. You've got a hockey player. You've got a figure skater. So he's got to kind of like reference all that. I mean, this is a lot of work for both penciler and inker. And I'm hoping to say, because these things had a higher price point, newsstands made a better margin off of treasuries than the regular comic book. I really hope that people like Trimpy got a better page rate. I'm hoping that maybe that's why he did it, is because he was busy with doing other books for Marvel. But like just the sheer amount of stuff he has to draw is a lot. And I got to wonder if he gets these scripts from Bill Mantlo and he's like, oh my God, you know, jeez. That said, related to a plot device, plot part of this thing. Now, maybe I missed it. I read this comic a couple of times over the years. But like, why does Peter Parker have such kind of like a crush on Brad? Did I miss something? Like, he really loves Brad.
Yeah, Brad's kind of he was like a big time athlete in high school. Like, cause they went to high school together, right? He mentions.
Oh, maybe I missed that. Maybe I missed that part. Although I think Peter would not be idolizing anything from high school, considering his...
Believe so.
Maybe I missed that. Okay, maybe that's they have the connection or something. Okay.
There is a connection. There's a hometown connection with them, and I'm
trying that makes sense. To... Because he looks a lot like Flash Thompson. He looks like the kind of guy that Peter got bullied by. And so when Peter's going on, but he's like, good for you, Brad. And Spider-Man's going to help you make sure you're around to help you get your chance. I'm like, wow, he's really crushing hard on this Brad.
Yeah, it's actually on the same page. It's in the panel right in the center. He says, say, isn't it Brad Rossi, the Olympic skier? We went to Midtown High together.
Oh, yeah. Oh, all right. Yep, there it is.
And the guy's like, you know, yeah, you think he'll grant an interview? He says, well, I'm a photographer and not a reporter. And, so there's a little bit of, I guess, just establishing how they
know each other.
So, but he's, I don't know. He doesn't seem as, he does. Oh, later on, he's like watching Brad and he's standing there with like Brad's girlfriend and they're both like, they are kind of crushing. Yeah. It's page 22 and 23. Trippy is obviously having fun with these double page spreads. The one for chapter 2 where Hulk gets trapped in the glass is like, you know, panel of Hulk bouncing.
It's great. Yeah.
Just like gets hit at the wrong time. And he's, just shocked as he usually is. And then 3 is Brad on the ski jump. And just this one of those, classic comic book crowd shots at an event. And he's like, there goes your boyfriend. He looks like a real winner. And she's like, Brad's dreamed this Olympic gold medal all his life. It's almost like he's a Flash Thompson who's not a total douche.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of the thing. But of course, Herb Trimpy drew the Hulk for many years. So this stuff was all he could do in his sleep. You know, yeah. I mean, at this point, Trimpy had drawn so much Marvel comics that he probably didn't even need reference for like the Lava Men, he just knew what those looked. He knew what those guys looked like. He's like, oh yeah, the Lava Men.
I would imagine that's probably why they had him do this, and that he probably could just. They knew he could just knock it out. I mean, he was really a workhorse for Marvel for most of his career.
It really was. I mean, not to like bring the show down a little, but there was an article that came out, I remember a bunch of years ago, where like Trimpy wrote about what it was like to be an artist who kind of got grandfathered out because you know, times went by, and how much he struggled to kind of like find a career after that. I mean, after he was an all-star at Marvel Comics for many, many years, and then he just became like persona non grata because taste changed. And his stuff all of a sudden looked kind of old you know, old hat. And he just, Marvel just basically kind of was like, well, it's been nice, you know? Yeah. And it was a little like, well, what do you do when you're 55 years old and your career, you know? And he wrote it in like a diary form. And it was really, you know, as someone who was a professional illustrator for many years, it was illuminating and sadly recognizable to see, like, wow, this guy really had to kind of struggle afterwards, considering how many pages he delivered and things like that. So, I mean, and again, he does do a great job. That the page 21, page 19, where Hulk picks up the giant cannon and hits the lava bin with it, and it's just two giant panels. He's really making use of the Treasury format here and there, you know, like really picking some moments to get really huge and deliver like that kind of big screen, widescreen entertainment that the Treasury format was good at.
Yeah. And they give the Hulk something to do in this whole thing. You know, whereas sometimes when you have these team ups, one of the heroes seems like really, really out of place. You know, it's like, do they really like, because I've read issues of Marvel team up where I wonder what Spider-Man's even doing there, you know?
Right. Because
clearly they just wanted Moon Knight or Cloak and Dagger or somebody, just they wanted them in that book and they wanted to showcase them, and Spidey's just kind of there. Here, the two heroes do get their fair, they get equal time and they get something that fits their capacity, like Hulk smashing this catapult and being entranced, because this is kind of the Hulk's classic dumb phase. Hulk smash phase, and getting lured into this. But then, of course, like you mentioned, they're feeding him. He's like, no, I'm just going to sit here and eat.
I'm going to sit here and eat Hulk hungry. I mean, for both companies, as the Treasury started getting phased out, they really turned them over to just their marquee characters. Mm-hmm. It was basically just Superman and Batman and Rudolph thrown in. I know, amazing. But it was just, you know, for DC, it was Superman and Batman. And for Marvel, it was Spider-Man and Hulk. They basically just toggled between Spider-Man, Hulk. And then for something like this, put them together. I do like on page 22, 23, the splash page, the chapter 3, Slaughter in Subterranea. We see some Marvel cameos. It's a lot of the Marvel Universe are there in plain clothes, just visiting the Olympics. We see what's clearly Matt Murdock and Natasha Romanoff in their clothes. Mm-hmm. And then we see even the Fantastic Four is there. And there's even the Thing. We see him sucked on the bed. He's got a fedora on, and there he is.
There's
that Superman versus Muhammad Ali kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that right next to Peter, that's either Tony Stark or that's Stephen Strange.
I'm betting it's... My hunch feels like it's Tony Stark, but yeah, it could be either one. But yeah, that's fun. You know, I mean, again, look at that. Look at how many people are on these two pages. Look at these. Look how many figures he has to draw. And then for Bruce Patterson, he's got to ink all this stuff. He's got to put all these lines in. Like, this is like a lot of work. You know, this is a lot of damn work. And so then on the very next page, where the guy's doing the ski jump, there's a bunch of panels with no background at all. And that, first of all, I think it works visually. It kind of gives it like the guy is just frozen in the air. He's so high up, there's nothing behind him. But it also works just on a pure, you know, getting it done level of like, okay, I drew these two previous pages that are filled with 50 people and a million things going on. Here's half a page where there's just a figure, just a single figure.
Yeah. I like the show of motion across those four panels at the top of page 24. It really does feel like, It does feel slightly animated, you know, because then he is moving and changing his position and doing what a ski jumper does in the matter of seconds that they're in the air, you know, when you watch competitive ski jumping and stuff.
Yeah. So. I do like it when the Mole Man shows up, because the Mole Man is one of those villains that, like, he obviously, you have to kind of take him seriously because he's the Mole Man a little bit, but also a lot of the Marvel heroes, when they kind of run into him, are kind of like, oh, the Mole Man, you know, they're kind of like rolling their eyes a little. And I like the Mole Man's like, Spider-Man, you will help me. Because Spider-Man's like, no, he's like, no, I'm not doing that. Get it, Mole Man. Now he blasts it with his thing, his staff, and he knocks Spider-Man out. But I just like that. I guess in the hierarchy of the Marvel Universe, like the Mole Man is just not anybody that he's not any villain that anybody's particularly threatened by.
Well, like, and they have apparently he's been around here and there, because they make reference to Fantastic Four 127 and Annual 13, so he keeps showing up for some reason.
And I agree with you about Kala. She is rocking a very New Gods-y kind of look. Mm-hmm. I could definitely see that. And again, I love that she lures the Hulk to her palace. She says, "You're going to be my king." And it's like, the Hulk does the Hulk even have, not, this is a horrible question, but it's like, the Hulk even have like a sex drive, you know? I mean, we know we love Jarella. I remember that was, he fell in love with her, but short of that, I think the Hulk doesn't think like that. And I love that, like, they're serving him all this food and they're, you know, he's got these giant bowls of food. He's just slurping. That's all he cares about. Like, Hulk's just like a real typical dude. He's like, just leave me alone. I just want to eat. I'm fine.
It's like when it's very Homer Simpson.
Yes, it really is. He prefers the company of men. Who doesn't? So then, you know, now I will say one thing that this story kind of, if I feel the need to compare it, which is ridiculous, to the Laugh Olympics treasury, is that the Laugh Olympics treasury really kind of crowbarred an Olympics segment into it. In like one or two pages, they really were sort of like, "Oh yeah, we got to throw them." This Bill Mantlo does a little more to kind of turn it into, okay, let's get the Olympians. The moment's going to give them these souped up, you know, equipment, the power skis and the rocket racer kind of sled thing, and the nuclear powered hockey stick. And so he does manage to work the idea of Olympians and Olympics more into it. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's just completely, you imagine if they tried to make this as a movie, this would cost like $100 billion. I mean, just the amount of effects that's going on, but he does at least bring Olympians into it a little more, which again, it's probably easier to do because they're humans as opposed to the Laugh Olympics. What are you going to do? Have Olympians play against Penelope Pitstop or something? But I like that Mantlo is kind of, again, he's in there pitching. Like, he's like, oh yeah, let's give the Olympians superpowers so they can kind of play at the Marvel level.
Yeah, and they're like, "Well, you leave us no choice." I know that with Brad, his girlfriend Heather has been turned into an old woman, so he's like, "You leave us no choice. We'll fight your war." And they're all like showing off their powers. And you know, the last time I saw somebody fight this seriously on skis, it was the opening scene of The Spy Who Loved Me. But as Andy and I talked about on a show a while ago, where it's like, you know, James Bond super spy being the furthest thing from a spy.
Yep.
but yeah, the jet powered skis, and I guess it's a bobsled.
Like a super powered bobsled. Yeah, it's fantastic. And I love, only in the Marvel universe do regular people, when they are given superpowers, immediately adapt to having them. You know, like regular people are like, "Oh, look at this! All of a sudden, I can smash things with my fist," and they just do it. You know, as opposed to a regular person who's like, "What? I'm a monster. I'm a gay, you know, I'm afraid to touch anything." But here, everyone's immediately like, "Oh yeah, I can just handle all this equipment. This is all good." I love the Mole Man's closed circuit TV network that he's got with Cal. Like, who put that in? Who wired all that stuff? I know.
It is I. Like, okay, you just hone in on, you know. Yep. That's the only thing that happens in comic books and cartoons, like these giant video screens, and somehow that villain always knows how to break into that frequency. You know, I get it on Star Trek. It's the future. You can, they have the means of doing it, and it's essentially the military probably has been doing that to each other for thousands of years or hundreds of years at that point. But this is just like, you know,
yeah,
a random monitor in like a cave in Lake Placid, New York. And it's like, yep, here's Mole Man on my TV.
I can't get Peacock to connect properly, let alone the Mole Man's got a subterranean inner office network that works flawlessly. But again, that's the Marvel Universe. So then we get to the big moment where all of Lake Placid is shunted into the air on these pylons. And I can't help it, but when I saw this, I couldn't help but think of Avengers Age of Ultron. It's like, okay, these are the Lake Placid Accords here are going to be after this. This entire city has been put on pie. And again, it's so Bill Mantlo and Stephen Grant and Mark Gruenwald, again, just kind of going for broke. You know, just like, let's just be as absurd as possible. All of Lake Placid is just shunted 1,000 feet into the air. And instead of people freaking out, they just start to continue just kind of like, run around on there, and they're like, okay, well, I guess we're just going to imagine, like, you know, all of a sudden your city is, you're right on the edge. You're peering down. You're like, this is terrifying.
There are houses literally falling off the edge of this.
It's great. It's
there, clearly people have died.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. And like all the vegetation and all the, you know, just think of all, you know, and then, you know, of course, in the end of the story, it's all going to get replaced, but like it just connects all up again or something. It's like, no.
And the narration boxes are, it is with great consternation that the tiny rural community of Lake Placid looks up to find that their duty as host has been superseded, at the 1980 Winter Olympics has somehow been taken away from them. I think they're concerned about a little more than that, guys.
Yeah, if you look at the page where Lake Placid is being pushed, you can see like there are houses right at the edge. There are cars right on the edge. Like, you know, a bunch of people are going to fall to their deaths here. Because, you know, it's absolutely hysterical. It's just like, you're like, yeah, of course. Why not? This is what you paid $2. You want this kind of action. And then we get to the actual, as they call it, the contest of champions, which, again, that phrase will figure back into the Olympics history momentarily. And then we get the big fight between the Olympians and Spider-Man versus Hulk. And you know, it's kind of funny. We talked about it, Ryan Daly and I talked about it when we covered Batman versus the Hulk, that treasury. And, you know, Len Wein had to kind of dance around that, of course, Batman cannot defeat the Hulk in any measure. That's never going to happen. And he gets away with it by doing the whole thing where he gasses the Hulk and then kicks him in the stomach long enough to knock him out. But I like in this story that they immediately just are like, Spider-Man's like, look, I'm going to die if I try to fight the Hulk. So I just have to kind of keep evading him and biding for time. I kind of like that they don't even bother to even pretend that Spider-Man has even a shot at landing even the smallest punch on the Hulk, because he's the Hulk.
Yeah. 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 Why? I'm on page 46. Why is the goalie's net on fire?
I don't know why half the things are happening at a certain point. And again, he's getting hit by lava, I guess, I think. Because there's a flame cannon that's hitting into that. So, yeah. I mean, could you imagine if this had been done, as you mentioned it, like a Saturday morning, if this had been done as like a double-length episode of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends or something? It would have been insane. Iceman would have fit in actually quite well. Yeah. Spider-Man's just like, look, I have no chance of defeating the Hulk, so I have to just stay away from him as long as possible until he wakes up from his drug-induced kind of haze so he can remember, because he's like, I don't know who Bugman is. And he's like, this is great. And then, you know, you mentioned Mole Man being an incel, and he is a little incel-y. But then when Kala, you know, reverts back to her original form, which is as a very, very old woman, she's no longer getting the benefits of the Fountain of Youth, Mole Man takes her in. He's like, I love you anyway. I love you. I don't really care about your appearance, which, of course, Mole Man is blind. So that's easy, but it's kind of like kind of sweet, really, amid all the destruction that he's caused.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, the whole cake takes care of that. He just kind of it's not the Sokovia thing, because the thing comes down and it doesn't destroy anything.
No.
It's just kind of like he just kind of goes boom, 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 and just kind of smacks it back into place.
When it's that whole like when all you have is a hammer, all your problems look like nails. It's just like the Hulk. Exactly. Hulk's just like, I just smashed stuff back into the ground, and he literally just shoved using brute force. Again, the physics of this, who can understand? Because the Hulk is pounding it from Lake Placid, so how does he even have the leverage to do this? But he manages to pound the city back, and they're just like, oh yeah, everything's all right. Lake Placid's just back to normal. Despite the fact there are, 50-foot pylons now buried deep into the earth?
Yeah.
I guess. But, you know, all right. And then the Hulk, being the Hulk, just walks away. He's like, all right, I'm done. He just, and then he says, go for someplace else where Hulk is not hounded. And like, okay, that's it.
It's not even that. So it's not even the walking away with the piano at the end of an episode. It's I just want to go away here, someplace warm. It's like, screw this.
Me too. Yeah, and then Spider-Man is left to talk to the Olympians, and then they said Brad mentions about that he sacrificed everything to risk to save Heather, his girlfriend, and that's when Spider-Man is like, that's why you'll always be a champion, Brad. And again, it's just such a weird thing to end the story on, that Spider-Man's just like so in love with this guy. It's just like, that's why you're a true champion. We're like, wow, Spider-Man, you are all in on Brad.
It's the moral lesson from the Filmation cartoon, right? Yeah. That's what makes a true Olympian: winning or losing, not winning or losing, but understanding the true importance of the contest. Remember that, and you'll always be a champion, whether you give you a gold medal or not. So that's totally the message for the kids that, like, you know, it's not just about winning, you know, it's sportsmanship and, I don't know, saving the world from the under people or whatever it is.
Yeah, I guess that's the moral, is it? Saving the world from mole men? I don't know, maybe, possibly. I mean, this thing for a 62-page story, which is a lot of room. That's a big story. Mantlow, and again, and the others, they give you like 90 pages worth of plot. I mean, he just...
Yeah. Oh, they shove a lot in here.
Yeah. I mean, he just, again, Mantlow, you know, you can say whatever you want about how cheesy it is or whatever. But man, again, he was giving readers their money's worth, because this, this thing needs to be a big spectacle. That's why you do it as an all original Treasury edition. And it is. It's a giant, crazy spectacle filled with 1,000 characters running around, 1,000,000 motivations, a couple of villains, a big, you know, kind of like third act thing of like plastic being shoved into the air. It's just, it's everything that Bill Mantlo kind of excelled at, is that kind of writing of just like, this is the crazy Marvel universe and let's just enjoy it. And, you know, it dabbles into the real world of the Olympics, which is sort of, those things are always kind of a weird blend to have the real world creep into the, because it's almost like, wait a minute, in a world where like we have superheroes, the Olympics are a thing. It kind of reminds you of that line from Kingdom Come, you know, where it was like, well, we stopped doing sporting events because what was the point of, you know, human achievement once you have heroes that can do all these things? So it's like, in a world where Captain America can, you know, probably beat any Olympian at anything, he's not part of it. The Olympics is still its own thing, and you have to just kind of put it off in your mind like, okay, there are still Olympics, even though this is a world with the Hulk and Spider-Man.
Especially when Marvel's got, at this point, this is 79, and actually looked this up, what was out on the stand from Marvel this time. This was Uncanny X-Men number 131. So the very beginning of the Dark Phoenix saga was out. This is a world of mutants, right? So it doesn't make a lot of sense that, you know, in a world of so many mutants that you'd have this, but, you know, whatever, it still works. It's just a fun story and such. And they're going to do coming this summer, Marvel Superheroes at the Summer Olympics.
Well, right, that's what we got to talk about. Is that on the inside? And we'll, again, you'll see this ad on the gallery page. On the inside back cover is an ad that says, "Coming this summer, Marvel Superheroes at the Summer Olympics." And we see a bunch of heads. We see Captain America and Wolverine, Black Panther, Storm, Thing, Hulk, Falcon, Spider-Man. Spider-Man's head, surprisingly small in this collage. Captain Britain. Iron Fist. We see a lot of the characters from other nations. We see a lot of the characters represented from other nations. Now, of course, obviously, Marvel was expecting figured that this Winter Olympics book would sell really well. And so then they would do a follow-up Treasury edition of the Marvel Superheroes at the Summer Olympics. But of course, the U.S. ended up boycotting those games and the book got canceled. And Marvel, never throwing anything away, took basically all the material they had and did a lot of whiteouting. For those of you too young to remember, whiteout was a little liquidy surface invented by Mike Nesmith's mom, which helped do paste-ups. And they took out all of the references to the Olympics and converted the story into what would end up being the miniseries Contest of Champions. That's what happened. They took all – in fact, they're online. You can find some of these Contest of Champions pages. And if you look close enough, you can literally see some of the whiteout has started to fade. And some of the original dialogue is poking through, or figures are poking through. But that's what they did. So, I mean, I've enjoyed Contest of Champions because it was a fun miniseries. It was just a big fight with all the Marvel characters. But I'm always bemoaning the loss of a Treasury, because this would have been a Treasury. This would have been a Treasury edition. It would have been a Summer Olympics. But we never got that. And it got changed into Contest of Champions. So, again, Marvel, you know, they paid for it. They were like, we're not throwing this out. So they turned it into a miniseries and ended up being pretty popular.
Yeah. And so just looking at Mike's Amazing World, it looks like there's only two more issues of the Marvel, well, three if you count the second Superman, Spider-Man crossover, yep. But there's a Hulk one right after this, and there's a sensational Rampaging Hulk, and then Sensational Spider-Man is number 27, and then that's it.
That's it. Yep.
You have the crossover ones, and like I said, they did a G.I. Joe one, and then the format kind of faded.
After that, Marvel turned it over to all their licensing. They did a Smurfs Treasury. Mm-hmm. They did an Annie Treasury, which we've covered here on the show. Yeah, they were like, all right, all the licensed characters, that's what we're going to do with it.
Gotcha. I haven't read a lot of these. This was an original story. Did they tend to be original stories, or was it like, because I know some of the DC ones have just essentially what's a lot of reprints. Like some of those Rudolph ones were just reprints of old stuff from like the 50s.
It was strange in that both companies decided, I guess they realized that the reprints, weren't selling as well as they used to. And then mm-hmm. they eventually sort of turned them into all original stuff. Because then DC literally changed the name of the series from Limited Collector's Edition to All New Collector's Edition. Mm-hmm. And that's what brought us Superman versus Muhammad Ali, Superman versus Shazam, Superman versus Wonder Woman. And then Marvel was doing things like this, was doing these all original things. And you could see there's other treasuries where like they were clearly using the treasuries as, I don't know, this is kind of a pejorative sound to it, but like dumping grounds for inventory material. There's a treasury, I forget which one, I think it's the one just before this, that's a Spider-Man or it's a Hulk. No, it's a Hulk treasury. And at the, in the bottom, in the back, there's a Wolverine story, and you're like, why is this even here? And you're like, well, they must have paid for it for some reason. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, we got to run it somewhere. We paid for the pages, so let's just run it in the back here. You know, that's just kind of what the two treasuries became. But yeah, it's interesting that Marvel Treasury Edition only lasted two more issues when, had they done the Summer of Olympics, it would probably have been a treasury. So I don't know if once they decided to convert it to a regular series, they just said, these treasuries aren't selling that well anyway, let's just cancel the series. Or they would have kept it going to make sure the Olympics one came, the summer one came out. I don't know.
Yeah, who's our editor-in-chief at this point? It is Shooter, but it's the very beginning of Shooter's era, because he took over in what, a couple of years before this, right?
77, 78?
So, and then... Because I know he had a rule that everything had to go out on time, but that would have been really more enforced as you get into the 80s, where they would dump inventory stories into like Daredevil or Spider-Man or whatever and interrupt the story because they just needed to get the book out on time and the writer was behind.
I forget what editor-in-chief it was. It wasn't Shooter. It might have been Marv Wolfman, because Marvel had that round table of editors in chief.
Yeah, it's kind of revolving door for a while.
I mean, whoever was painting the name on the door was constantly busy. It was like, oh, Tony Isabella, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Roy Thomas. But I remember one of them came up with a book, an in-house book called called Marvel Inventory Comics or something. Mm. And the gist of it was a monthly series that was produced in-house. It was never meant to be published, but it was put on the schedule as if it was a regular book, where they would hire different writer-artist combos to produce stories featuring multiple Marvel characters that were one-and-dones.
Huh.
And that inventory was produced and then put in a drawer. And then any time one of the regular creative teams on one of the regular series couldn't make their deadlines, they could slot one of these stories in. So it was like, okay, we're going to commission a one and done with Spider-Man, Thing, and the Submariner. And then, FF is late this month. Boom, we'll run that. Spider-Man's late. Boom. And it was built that way. And they would let this inventory pile up in the drawers for just that purpose. It was just that kind of stuff. And it's really pretty clever kind of do that, to kind of make sure we're always going to deliver something all original. Before we finish up on the Winter Olympics, I do want to mention the back cover. Because you've got this Olympic skier who is in the middle of going down the slum, and right at that moment, the Mole Man is coming out of his subterranean passageway, and the skier is like, "What?" You know, as he's being lifted into the air by the Mole Man. Now, it's very interesting. If you look at the cover credits, it is listed as, you see the artist's signatures, Sienkiewicz Patterson.
Yeah.
79. And so this is an early pencil job by the legendary Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yeah.
And it says something about probably how early he was at his style. You know, early on, his style was not as recognizable as it, of course, would become. And that Patterson was probably a pretty heavy inker. That I don't think you could possibly think this was Bill Sienkiewicz unless you saw his name.
Yeah, that surprised me because I it matches enough to the front cover too.
Yeah.
You know, because on the thing you sent me, they're back to back, right?
Yep.
So I'm looking at it on my iPad here, and they match up just well enough on the thing, and I guess I can see a little bit of Bill Sienkiewicz in the skiing figures there. But yeah, Bruce Patterson had a heavy hand on this, or like you said, he's very, I mean, it's not until what, about 4 or 5 years later, where he's starting to become
Bill Sienkiewicz,
you know, the New Mutants and some of the other pinups and covers that he does. But again, I would imagine that somebody like him, who he would go on in the 90s, he would actually have quite a bit of inking work people. Like, I think he inked Jim Aparo
at one point or another. Jim Aparo's last ever Aquaman story is inked by Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yeah, and I remember him doing Batman, and he was, I'd have to look at it again. I recall him being a pretty solid inker for Aparo, as opposed to Klaus Janson, who was not. But I would imagine that Sienkiewicz is more versatile than like you would imagine seeing a lot of his work.
Yep.
That if Marvel or Shooter or whoever, you know, told him this is what this is for, even if he was more avant-garde, he probably would have reined that in for the purpose of knowing who the audience is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is one of the great, I think, sort of tragedies of the timing, in that the Treasuries disappeared right as some really, as you good word for it, avant-garde kind of artists came in. And it would have been amazing to see like Frank Miller or Bill Sienkiewicz or Klaus Janson or Walt Simonson, you know, get a hand at doing. Can you imagine a Walt Simonson Thor Treasury, what that would look like, you know?
Yeah, that would
like,
have been amazing.
Yeah, I mean, like the Beta Ray Bill story. You know, but done as a Treasury. I mean, oh my God. And it was right as Marvel was allowing these artists with a kind of more distinct style to come in, the Treasuries went away. And I mean, you think about how beautiful New Mutants looked under Bill Sienkiewicz, his painterly style. And like, can you imagine what it would have looked like bigger and, you know, on less crappier paper? That might have just been a
And they would have books in the early mid 80s, like Marvel Fanfare.
Right.
And then they would have
novels. They did
graphic novels. Yep. But even then, those were so nascent in there because it was that. And then they had Epic Illustrated, obviously, and some of the magazines. But they were so nascent in there and such an experiment that those guys didn't get like what they could have done with it. Because, like, you know, I have a God Loves Man Kills, and Brent Anderson did the art in that. And it is absolutely gorgeous, and the coloring is gorgeous, you know. So I could imagine like a Sienkiewicz or a Miller or somebody like that, or Walt Simonson, even on that graphic novel format, would have been really fun to see. But they never, for whatever reason, really didn't, with just some exceptions, they really didn't push it in that direction yet. I guess they weren't sure how well these things were going to sell. I could imagine they were crazy expensive to produce too.
Yeah, I mean, again, as the collector market, we've talked about this on many, many episodes of Treasury Cast, but as collectors became the dominant market for comics, that's the Treasury format lost its appeal because you couldn't store them and you couldn't keep them in mint condition, and that became a big thing. You know, I mean, these books, as you talked about that Rudolph with all the colors, the coloring done in, these things were kind of meant to be, you know, half and half like activity books. In some regard. And they were meant to be more interacted with. I mean, good Lord, all the DC, you know, for the first like 3 years of the Treasuries, all the DC back covers are meant to be cut out and turned into dioramas, for Pete's sakes. I mean, they're meant to be kind of become a thing to fill your kid's day. They're not meant to be kept in beautiful mint condition and put in a plastic bag and not ever looked at again. So it's just, it's a format that a collector is just kind of like, no, where can I store this? I can't put it in my long box. What are you going to do? So, you know, the days were numbered for Treasuries anyway.
Yeah. And this is because this is something you would have found at a toy store,
yep,
like a Toys R Us, or on the next to the coloring books.
Yep.
You know, you go into the stationery store with dad. He lets you go look at the stuff while he goes by. He buys cigarettes because it's 1979.
Yeah.
You gotta put something in that ashtray you made him in art class. And it was like a cottage industry in elementary schools through the 70s and 80s.
I made a lot of cutting boards. That's all I
remember. Yeah, cutting boards.
A lot of cutting boards.
But yeah, like, but it would be. It would be next to the, you know, it would be next to the Spider-Man and Star Trek the Motion Picture coloring books. Gray, I had a Star Trek the Motion Picture coloring book, man.
A lot of gray crayons for that one. Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said earlier, like, the part of the appeal of these treasuries was they were at a higher price point. And so
whoever was
selling them made more money than they did off of a traditional comic book. And it might have been a little bit of a stretch, but I could picture something like this being racked in, like, the sporting department. In a department mm-hmm. store, you know, like, you're like, as you're talking about, like, the kid is being dragged along by his dad mm-hmm. to get, you know, a basic catcher's mitt or whatever. And, oh, look, there's the Winter Olympics thing. Cause it was like, they're trying to cross over. They, you know, they were trying to do those sorts of things of putting comics were still being sold in weird locations.
Yeah.
Because the idea was, well, yeah, this store is for adults, but these people presumably have kids, and let's give the kids something to, you know, to catch their eye. And so I could have imagined at sporting goods stores, which after all still exist to this day, that you would maybe sell something like this because there might be some crossover appeal. You know, like, oh, it's like the Winter Olympics. Look at that. I didn't know that Spider-Man and the Hulk went to the Olympics. That's cool. They'll drop $2 on this. Sure, why not?
Yeah, this is perfect grandma bait. You know, like my aunt Frances would have totally bought this for me when I came over. And here you go. And like, oh, wow. You know, I know you like superheroes, and like flipping through this while they, you know, have cake and coffee. And like, you know, and this occupies me for quite a while at, you know, when I'm little. So, yeah.
Perfect. Exactly what comics were meant to be for. So, well, again, it's big, goofy fun.
Oh, yeah.
And I, you know, this was one of those things that, like, the minute that they met, you know, like a couple of years ago when I knew the Winter Olympics was coming, I was like, oh, this will be perfect to line up to do this. I'll just wait until we get a chance to do it. And now we're here. So, Tom, thank you so much for finally coming by on the Treasury Cast. And thanks for talking about this very, very fun, goofy book with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And I do have to ask, I don't think a lot of these have been collected, at least the original stories, right? Like,
not much. It's basically the team-ups, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But most of the all-original Treasury material. I mean, like the Superman, Spider-Man, Superman, Shazam, the Superman, mm-hmm. Wonder Woman, they've been collected in. But a lot of this original material that Marvel did, as far as I know, no, it's never been reprinted anywhere. So you can only really get them in this.
That'd be a cool oversized trade, although I don't know if there's a market for it, but to justify its printing. But that'd be a really fun oversized trade.
DC has been putting out these keepsake editions of some of their classic treasuries lately. They're just doing the next month, the Legion one will be out.
Oh, really?
The wedding, where they fight, not they fight Mordru, that's the other edition, but where whoever it is gets married. I forget those characters in that one. But and they did like the Superman, Spider-Man. They did the Bible. So DC's been doing them. Marvel, not so much. Marvel's been doing those kind of weird oversized books, but they're not really treasuries. They're more like trade paperbacks that are just slightly bigger. It's kind of a weird thing. But no, I mean, yeah, this material's still out there. You know, they still can do it. I mean, if they wanted to. So
somebody's got it.
It's sitting, it's sitting, you know, these are digital files sitting on somebody's hard drive over at Marvel. So, well, Tom, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Sure. I've got two shows over on the Two True Freaks Network. One is Required Reading with Tom and Stella. Stella, who is the host of Batgirl to Oracle, she and I take a look at a work of literature every month and do our book club review thing. And then my main show is called Pop Culture Affidavit. It's everything random in the world of popular culture, from books to comics to TV, movies, you know, music, you name it. And you can also find that at popcultureaffidavit.com. And you can find me on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F.
Very cool. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Movies, TV, comics, music. Pop Culture Affidavit has it all. It's everything random in the world of popular culture, and it's all covered by me, Tom Paneris. New episodes drop monthly at twotruefreaks.com, and be sure to check out blog posts about random pop culture topics at popcultureaffidavit.com. Pop Culture Affidavit, the sworn testimony of a dork.
Howdy, Nicholas Prom here. I want to tell you all about my new show, Captain Freakout Psychedelic Radio. It's a weekly block of mind-altering music from the 60s, 70s, and beyond. Tune in, turn on, and freak out wherever groovy podcasts are consumed. That's Captain Freakout's Psychedelic Radio, available on all podcasting platforms.
And we're back with listener feedback, and this is the feedback we got for episode 65 of Treasury Cast, Limited Collector's Edition Batman, with my guests Paul Kinn and Sean Myers, hosts of the Batman Family Reunion podcast here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. First up, Jason Keen, who says, top-notch show, Mama's Family reference puts it over the top. Thank you, Jason. I feel so seen. Martin Gray says, what a fun cross-promotion for Batman Family Reunion. Mind, this seems a bit of a mishmash, so as far as treasuries go, no great villains or landmarks, and the nearest to a proper theme being cleaning ladies. I love Jerry Robinson and Dick Sprang, but they don't much benefit from the bigger format. Martin, those new look Batman stories were nice looking, but a bit dull. While that Denny and Neil story was underwhelming, wasn't that just covered somewhere recently? Model cities, though, this is what we want. And then Captain Entropy follows up with Martin. The Adams and O'Neill story was covered in Nightcast number 28. Well, how quickly they forget, Chris and Ryan who? It was followed by snide commentary on the absurdity of the death trap and pedantic commentary on the dutiful Batman employee to save himself. I know, because I was the snidliest and most pedantic, but in my defense, Liz Ann and others joined in. That doesn't make it right, Captain. Mike Zumo says, the Deep Sea Diver episode was adapted into TV for The Adventures of Superman, Perry White's Scoop. I had no idea, Mike. Thank you. Captain Entropy comes back to say, thank you all for a very enjoyable episode about what sounds to be a fair to middling Batman treasury. Of course, a mediocre Batman treasury is still pretty good, so I don't want to sound like a complaint. I especially enjoyed the synopses, the masterfully integrated plugs, and the discussions of the art. I'll pay more attention to Dick Sprang's work next time I see it. I tend to take the pre-New Age look artists for granted. Yeah, I mean, look, Dick Sprang is a kind of acquired taste because it's so not mystery Batman the way we've all been, you know, kind of waiting in for the last, I don't know, 40 years. But I don't know, it just has such a beautiful energy to it that I just love it. And so contra Martin Gray, I actually think Dick Sprang benefits from being blown up to a bigger size. I think the work is so tight. Chris Franklin, of course, from our network says, Dick Sprang is to Batman what Carl Barks is to ducks. I agree. And then he continues, great episode, gents. That Wally Fox cover was, of course, also reissued on the DC Digest, so it got around. I've always loved it, and the Infantino Anderson original is based on. The classic rooftop image of Batman and Robin by Infantino and Anderson originated in a double-page pinup that ran to Detective 352 and was issued later that year with a set of poster pinups that were available in stores and via mail order through DC. The image of Batman and Robin in the Batmobile was created for that same set, I believe. I've always heard it and the rest of the pinups in the series were both by Infantino and Anderson, but there's a lot of confusion as to how much Infantino drew some of the licensed images, like the Captain Action Batman costume box and the Color Forms packaging. The evolution of the Wayne Foundation is interesting. It started out as the Alfred Foundation after Alfred died in Detective 327. When he got better, because comics, it was changed to the Wayne Foundation. When Bruce first moved out of Wayne Manor in Batman 210, where the Wayne Foundation building was a nondescript high-rise with a penthouse. Austin's redesign here would stick, so while, but a short while later, during Steve Englehart's early issues on Detective, He and Walt Simonson revealed Batman recreated a new Batcave below and moved much of the equipment and trophies from the original. Mego's playset was indeed called Wayne Foundation, but it's more or less a multi-level Batcave. Early prototypes showed they were actually going to recreate the look of the penthouse roof, but they abandoned it. Oh, that would have been so cool. Sorry to go on so long, but talking about classic Batman is like breathing air for me. Keep up the great work at the family reunion, Paul and Sean. Chris, I will never get tired of Batman-related trivia, especially anything related to merchandising. You know I love that stuff, so thank you for the info. By the way, he also follows up with, and I think Paul is right. The basic body of that Batman on the back cover looks very Kurt Swan. The production department seemed to get a lot of work on these treasuries, so maybe a junior woodchuck took a Swan figure and redrew it. It seems familiar. Again, thank you once again, Chris. Alexander M. Osiah says, holy cow, I think I owned a copy of this. Quick background refresher. Comics reading began at a young age back in the 70s with more focus on the DC Marvel universes in the 80s. Prior to that, it included Richie Rich, hi Rob, Peanuts, newspapers, etc. But our comic came from mixed sources. Legit imported comics, semi-legit printed comics by the National Bookstore, which seemingly ignored the intellectual property laws. But it was the Philippines in the 70s and early 80s, so no one cared. And surprisingly, comics that flowed in through the U.S. military bases. I remember reading this one and thought nothing much about the differences in art, just like some more than others. I was blown away by the stories and storytelling. It was also a matter of a rarity of superhero / SF / fantasy stuff. Anything I could find was super valuable. Really enjoyed this trip down memory lane. Thank you, Alexander. Edo Boznar says, man, listening to this today was like a soothing salve for my soul after a past few rather rough days. And to me, this was additionally an extra special episode of Treasury Cast, just like episode 44, which you covered when you covered C45. It was because this one I had back in the day. I already told that story about how I got them in the comments to the aforementioned episode. Here, I'll just add that I absolutely love the cover because it evokes such strong memories. To me, it's just one of the most iconic Batman images ever. So when a digest was released a few years later with the same cover art, I snapped it off the rack faster than a mongoose going after a cobra. And speaking of digests, I still read mine, a few that I have, but I do the same thing as well, Sean or Mike. I forgot who said it. I take off my glasses and put the book closer to my face. As for the actual content of the book, I have to say that the only story that really left a lasting imprint in my mind is the last one with the Neil Adams art. That and the Wayne Foundation illustration and schematics. Neither the image gallery nor your fine story summaries help jog my memory, but it's a great conversation anyway. Great job, everyone. Thank you, Ada. Martin Gray follows up regarding the digest. He says, it's funny how often people have problems with the digest. Didn't the DC production department actually tweak the size of the balloons to make them bigger? Or is that a myth that I've picked up? No, Martin, that actually is true. In some instances, they did redraw the word balloons to make them bigger. And you can look, there are some online sources where you can see they will compare the pages and see that the word balloons are all of a sudden taking up like a quarter more of the panel than they normally would. But I don't know, maybe it's my eyesight or whatever, or just the fact that the digests were printed on such cheap paper that even though a lot of my books are still in pretty good shape, the paper is browning, like all get out. And so between that and the still small type, I just do find them just kind of hard to read, regardless of the point size being a little bigger. Jason Keane came back to say, I'm in love with the image of the new Wayne Foundation building. Talk about swinging for the fences. I love classic comic book buildings, and despite this being my introduction to what the building looked like the new Wayne Foundation building is already one of my favorites. I've always enjoyed stories where the hero had a cool and iconic place to hang out. I knew there was a time when Bruce was away from the manor / cave, but I hadn't read any of the penthouse stories, snicker. As far as I could tell, I can recall only having ever seen the interior shots of Bruce Wayne's penthouse. Thanks for introducing me to such an iconic and perhaps a little silly-looking landmark. Ward Hill Terry says, like many of you who have already responded, I too have the digest with the same painting as its cover. As I recall, that digest also reprints the Wayne Foundation illustration. I love the Wayne Foundation building. It's an instantly recognizable building in comics. What does the Daily Bugle building look like? Or even the Daily Planet, Galaxy Communications building? All we care about at the Baxter building is the top five floors. Would you recognize Dr. Strange Sanctum Sanctorum if you couldn't see that window? The mansions Wayne, Avengers, and Xavier vary from artist to artist. The Wayne Foundation building stands apart. It is no less bizarre than any other comparable tower from the 1970s and much more attractive, in my opinion, than any brutalist structure of that era. There are buildings even now that may have one name or two or more towers, each with their own entrance. It's unlikely that one company would lease the office space in both unless they wanted to keep some divisions separate. You work in tower number one and you want to hang out with a colleague in tower number two, take the elevator down to the lobby and go up a different elevator. I see that as a good excuse to stay away from the desk a little longer. The penthouse was also instantly recognizable and cool besides. Bruce was ahead of his time. He had a green roof. I'd like to imagine the moat as a recirculating irrigation system for the foliage up there. I want this treasure just to look at Austin's drawings really big. Wow. I mean, okay. You know what? I have one thing, a couple things to say about the Wayne Foundation building. We're going to do one final comment here from Brett Young. And he says, first of all, I am in the same boat with Rob, Paul, and Sean. I cannot read my DC Digest anymore. They sit there mocking my eyes. Damn them. My favorite part of this Batman treasury is, guess, the Wayne Foundation building. Gaze upon this awesome 1970s architectural cocaine fever dream of a building. Who wouldn't want to be employed there? If you work in some of the higher floors, you could climb through the tree to the other side of the offices. A major hazard would be that first floor lobby must be littered with bird corpses having slammed into office windows after leaving their nests in the giant tree. And Bruce's bachelor pad looks like the Millennium Falcon topped with a lemon twist. Plus, the yard just ends. No fence or wall. Just some trees and a flat edge. How many of Bruce's romantic conquests became street pizza after wandering the grounds a bit too far while he sneaks out to save the city? Incredible. Terry Austin deserves the Pritzker Architecture Prize for this. Another great feature is the splash page Batman and Robin versus the glass bottom boat ride. Of course, Batman and Robin peeling out in one of my favorite Batmobile designs to cruise for swinging babes. All in all, a great treasury. As always, Rob, I'm going to bug you about covering Spider-Man versus the Hulk at the Winter Olympics. Hey, jinx. Brett, I can only say I hope you enjoyed this very episode. And man, people really love the Wayne Foundation building. It's a testament to how much, you know, I would imagine when DC put that treasury together and they had a couple of pages to fill, they threw this to Terry Austin. Oh, put in the Wayne Foundation building. They probably weren't thinking this was going to be much of a big deal. People are buying it for the stories. And yet, look at this, 40 years later, every single letter that we got is about the Wayne Foundation building. So it really struck a chord with people. Again, for those of you who haven't seen it, go check out that Mego playset. As Chris says, it really looks like it's just a big bat cave, but it's just fun that it was the Wayne Foundation loomed large enough that they branded a toy as that. So again, it really seemed to strike a chord with a lot of you out there that was very, very funny. So thank you all for the comments. It was great. I really appreciate it. A big thanks to Tom Panarese for coming by to Treasury Cast and talking about this Spider-Man versus Hulk at the Winter Olympics. I hope you're all enjoying the Olympics to whatever level you choose to engage with them. That's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Of course, you can find back episodes of our show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Treasury Cast on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking treasuries over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasury Cast. I very much appreciate it, fellas. So that's going to do it. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next month. But until then, go big or go home.
Headlining the powerful American speed skating team, brother and sister, husband and wife. Eric Heiden has won every major title in the last 3 years and is favored to win 5 gold medals in Lake Placid. His sister Beth is the 1979 all-around world champion. Leah Polis Mueller is the reigning sprint champion. And husband Peter is back to defend his 76 Olympic gold. American speed skaters racing to win the gold at home when the world comes to America beginning Tuesday, February 12th. The 1980 Winter Olympics exclusively on ABC.